Welcome back to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. John Suntress here with a February 2006 interview with artist-writer Keith Giffen. This was a Word Balloon episode that didn't make it to the current RSS feed. It was part of the original RSS feed. This being the anniversary year, I'm doing my best to get a lot of these old interviews up for people who haven't heard them. On some of these flashbacks, I'm going to do my best to kind of have them coincide with some current news. We all know that Keith Giffen and J.M. DeMatteis are returning to the Justice League universe, specifically on Booster Gold. Some interesting ideas might be popping up in the book in the weeks and months ahead. And as we're watching those happen, it's fun to look back at the things that Keith had to say about the Bwahaha style that he and Mark created for the series The Justice League, and continued on other books too. We mentioned their Defenders miniseries, and of course their work at Boom on things like Hero Squared and Planetary Brigade. We talk a lot about his years with DC, working on things like the Legion of Superheroes with Paul Levitz, his work on All-Star Comics revival in the early 70s, including the Justice Society, with guys like Jerry Conway, Wally Wood, and Carmine Infantino. Keith played a big part in the resurrection of the Blue Beetle, the Jaime Reyes version, with John Rogers and Cully Hamner, and we talk about the origins of that character. And we'll talk a lot about the opportunities that Ross Ritchie gave him to start making books at Boom Studios. Wanted to get some show business out of the way, Word Balloon show business, if you will. First of all, my association with Newsarama started back in April 2007. It's been a great relationship, but the time has come for us to part ways and do other things. So I humbly thank the guys over at Newsarama, from Mike Doran and Matt Brady to current guys like Lucas Siegel, who have been very kind in assisting me and getting my stuff up there. But time to take the show into a new direction. So we wish them well, and we amicably part ways. Convention news. I'm sorry to say I won't be at WonderCon. I had some car issues that came up just in time for tax time, and they were expensive enough that something had to give, and I guess the trip to San Francisco had to be sacrificed in order to pay the bills. So unfortunately, I will not be at WonderCon. I will be at C2E2 2 weeks later in Chicago, and at the Summit City Con 1 month later in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Beyond that, my convention plans for the rest of the summer are up in the air. I'm just trying to figure things out. I would imagine that I'll be going to at least one or two more cons, at least, before the end of the year. I've been haunting the last few episodes of Around Comics as that show winds down. Episodes from 269 to the current episode 271, you can find me there as a panelist. This week's episode, episode 271, was a doozy. Brian Salazar and I dominated the last 20 minutes of the show in a heated argument about the Green Hornet. I'm a big fan. I've got a post about it, in fact, at wordballoon.com. Make sure you check it out, and you should really listen to it. It was a very funny nerd debate, and we both got very heated in our beliefs, that either the Green Hornet was great or that he sucked. Sal thinks he sucks. He thinks there's never been a great story about the Green Hornet. Foolish, foolish man. I've been very pleased to see all the feedback that I've gotten here at Word Balloon, either via emails or message board comments. It's been very nice, and people seem to get that the Green Hornet's cool. In fact, I'm such a fan of the Green Hornets, I expect a lot more interviews with the various creators that are touching the subject, both at Dynamite Comics and also Moonstone Books' own short story collection, A Green Hornet Anthology, edited and illustrated by Ruben Procopio. A beautiful cover and great illustrations. Ruben's a friend, and I am looking forward to talking to Ruben in the weeks ahead about that project. You've already heard Matt Wagner talk about his Golden Age Green Hornet series for Dynamite, and I have a feeling we'll be talking to Phil Hester about his work on the Kevin Smith book, and also some of the other books that Dynamite is doing as well. I'm a big Green Hornet fan. I'm glad to see the character back. I love the Now Comics run back in the early 90s. Love the Van Williams show. And I'm even looking forward to Seth Rogen and Christoph Waltz's movie that's coming up at Christmas time. Okay, enough news. Now let's get on to our interview with Keith Giffen from February of 2006, right here on Word Balloon.
Welcome back to WordBalloon.com, the comic book conversation site. This is John Suntress. Mention the name Keith Giffen, and fans may think of many books. His humor runs on the JLA and Defenders with J.M. DeMatteis. DeMatteis and Giffen continue the hero humor with two current projects from Boom Studios, Hero Squared and Planetary Brigade. Keith also had historic runs on the Legion of Superheroes with writer Paul Levitz and as a solo creator. In addition, Giffen is a key component on major event books at Marvel and DC, in the plotting sessions and doing the art breakdowns of the weekly series 52, and as a writer on the Marvel Cosmic event Annihilation. Our conversation begins with a look back at the start of Giffen's career that ties into the current events of DC's Infinite Crisis.
I wanted to start at the beginning for you at DC because it kind of ties into the current storyline that's going on. Your first work was with All-Star Comics JSA Revival with Jerry Conway and Wally Wood.
Yeah. When I first broke into comics, I pretty much did everything wrong. I thought I knew it all. I figured it was nothing I could learn. I've been reading comics all my life. I know how to do this. And I got guys like Wally Wood, Joe Kubert, Carmine Infantino to just sit at their feet and learn from them. But I was too big a jackass. And yeah, it was funny because Carmine Infantino actually taught me everything I needed to know about comic book storytelling visually with a piece of tissue paper, a few abrupt lines, and a 10-minute talk. Back then, like I said, I was just too headstrong and too stupid to realize what he'd given me. And I'll tell you, I use what he said. He said, to this day, I still do it. I still work off of that little piece of tissue paper that he showed me. But yeah, my first stint in comics way back when with All-Star and the various other things, it was kind of disastrous.
Well, I point to that specifically because you did the Golden Age Superman, and what I thought was neat, and I read this in an article, I want you to confirm it, it was your idea to give him the Joe Shuster look again.
Boy, you're asking for a memory stretch. I seem to recall asking permission to do that, to put it into the breakdowns.
That's great.
And then Wally, of course, just knocked it out of the ballpark. I can't really say, you know, I can't say with 100% honesty, yep, that was my idea. But I do recall asking permission. Take that for what it's worth.
Okay.
It gets kind of muddy. Comics are really a collaborative process. You have so many people working on one book, and it's really incestuous. Like Bwahaha. Mark DeMatteis and I still argue over who came up with Bwahaha first. I swear it was him. And I read it in the comic and went, oh, that's cool. I think I'll work that to death. And Mark claims that it was me. Now, we could check, because we have the plot. We can check to show up in the plot first or in the story first. But it's not worth it. We came up with it. Okay, fine. We're cool.
And it's a subgenre now.
I suppose. It's going to become part of the comic book slang lexicon there. But, the Golden Age Superman, I always loved the way the Golden Age Superman looked. I always liked that kind of thick-necked, very stylized approach to the Superman character.
Much like the Fleischer cartoons as well.
Very much. Yeah, very much so. Fleischer, the Fleischer cartoons, as far as I'm concerned, got it right. They just did the Superman.
I was wondering, now you did the breakdowns and then the Wood Studio did the finishes on those stories.
Yeah.
Whose idea was it to really show off Power Girl's rack back then?
Wally Wood. I think we were all being told by Wally at one point that every issue he was going to draw Power Girl's breasts slightly larger until somebody at DC told him to stop. Well, as you can tell, nobody told him to stop. It was pretty deliberate, yeah. And it's also kind of, with Power Girl, Wally Wood can pull that kind of stuff off.
Sure.
It's worked really good, you know, and that just became sort of a running gag with Power Girl, the fact that she'll never drown.
And it was a good counterbalance, too, to her feminist stance of the 70s
as well. There's nothing wrong with women with curves, this whole, you know, androgynous type of look that seems to be taking hold again. I've never been a big fan of that. I like women with curves.
Sure, sure.
And apparently so did Wally.
Now, I'm wondering in terms of what's going on with 52 right now. Uh-huh. There are four main writers and you.
Yes.
You are doing the breakdowns.
Oh, yeah.
And you were involved with the plotting. At what point did your involvement begin in this whole big master plan that DC has going?
My part began when Dan Didio called me in his office and first said that, you know, I want to ask you something. And then ran through the idea of doing this weekly comic book. Asked me, is this even possible? Do you think this is even possible? And like an idiot, I said, yeah. I was kind of in it really early. I believe that the writers were involved in it, or at least in terms of pitching it and wanting to do it before I was. But I was brought on pretty early. I was brought on before it was even called 52. I attended the 52 meetings. It has been, again, it's that oddly incestuous collaborative process that 9 times out of 10 generates really good comic books. I'd like to point out right now, just sort of go on the record here as saying that when you have that many egos in a room, that many writers at the top of their game, it can get kind of, that's what I'm looking for, awkward. But to everyone's credit, everyone just put ego aside and just tossing ideas into this communal kitty for 52 with no guarantee that they would be able to work off of the idea that they came up with. It was just really a great across-the-board collaborative process. I was really impressed. There were absolutely no creative dust-ups. Nobody's trying to grab more than is their due. Grant Morrison put it best, you know, when the meetings were all done, he said, you know, I've always been kind of a solo actor, at least, you know, teamed up with somebody else, but now I feel like I'm part of a band. Yeah. Which I guess, you know, he sort of compared it to the Beatles once, which I guess makes me Pete Best.
Doesn't sound like it, man. Actually, it sounds like you're the one to keep in the real beat, because obviously the crucial thing, I think, to a weekly comic would be getting the art done. And that's all you know, supplying the breakdowns.
Well, so I don't want to take any more credit than I'm due here. I guess the best way to describe my participation in 52 is if you see these tug of war things that they have on the beach sometimes, if they do these Battle of the Network Stars. There, I just dated myself. I'm the guy at the end of the rope with the loop around his shoulder. I'm kind of the anchor man. I was specifically brought on board. Not only I contribute a bit to the plotting and to the creative process, but only to the extent that I can from my position. I'm not writing this stuff. I'm not actually writing chapters.
I understand.
But I'll tell you, taking the script and breaking them down visually and acting as kind of the watchdog to sort of put a little bit of texture in here, a billboard there to keep things kind of consistent. But my primary purpose is to keep the rhythm of the story consistent. When you have four or five, God knows how many artists working on this, and it's coming out weekly, each artist has their own internal rhythm as to how they tell a story.
Sure.
Chris Bautista is not going to break down a story the same way that Joe Bennett will. But by me coming in and providing the breakdowns, it means that even though you'll get Chris Bautista one issue and Joe Bennett the next, somebody else the next, it won't be too jarring because the pacing of the visuals and the storyboards, for lack of a better word, will stay consistent issue to issue to issue.
Sure, and that's something that I think DC has been successfully doing in the last year or two in terms of having artists jam even in the same book and still achieving a consistent look.
Well, that's because when these kind of projects come out, be it something like Infinite Crisis or 52 or whatever, Didio makes sure that the buck stops with a specific person, be it the editor or himself, so that, you know, it's some people call it, you know, being a control freak or micromanaging, but it's just making sure that everything remains consistent and everyone is on the same page. One of the things with Infinite Crisis and the things that DC's been doing that I've heard a lot is, well, all the books pretty much now have to kowtow to Infinite Crisis. A, it's not kowtowing. And B, yeah, they should, because if you're not marching in lockstep on a major event like this that's going to redefine your line of books for a long time to come, then, you know, the wheels are going to come off the wagon. Mm-hmm. You can't have one editor going, oh, 100% cooperation, absolutely, and another editor going, no, I don't want a piece of this. Everyone's got to be playing along. Everyone's got to be on the same page. And DC's been really good with that because, sometimes Didio will just step in and go, shut up, we're doing it this way. And to the outside, to an outsider, and even to me sometimes, I'll admit, you think, well, that's pretty harsh. He's just trying to do everything his way. When he's really trying to maintain creative consistency until they get to the end of this event, at which point, boom, it can blow up into all kinds of diversity. I know where DC's heading. I know where Infinite Crisis has been is going to wind up. I know where 52 is heading.
Mm-hmm.
I can see now how Identity Crisis was necessary to start the ball rolling. And I'll tell you, the destination is really, really worth it. If I didn't think so, I wouldn't be involved in 52.
That's cool. And didn't you do, weren't you in charge of a big event post-crisis years ago? Was Invasion or?
In charge is, you know, in charge makes people think you're calling the shots. I was instrumental in pulling together Invasion.
Yes.
And also the sort of modest crossover, the Eclipso thing. So yeah, I do have kind of experience with it. But Greg Rucka put it best when Didio at the meeting throughout the question, sometimes these things just don't work. Why not? And look, I hit it on the nose, because some people won't play.
Right.
Some people just decide they don't want to play. Well, Dan steps in and goes, okay, you're playing, period. You know, and you've got to do that. You can't have all the books except a handful of Batman books moving in a specific direction, and then, you know, it just doesn't work. It starts fragmenting.
Sure.
So, yeah, DC is getting better and better and better at pulling these things together, but only because Didio or the people who are helming the project aren't out there to make friends. They're out there to give good product. And if that means just, you know, no, you're doing it this way, period, that's what they'll do.
How many artists, you mentioned two of them, how many artists are going to be drawing 52?
I don't know. At last count, I believe Wacker was juggling close to six.
Okay.
Keep in mind, it's a weekly comic.
Absolutely.
And once this thing starts coming out, it's going to be bang, 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 bang every week. We're taking this lead in time right now to get as many issues done as is humanly possible, because we don't want to reach the point where the artist is having to really flame through the assignment.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly because that's not fair. It's not fair to the artist. Everybody on a big event like this, where everyone's going to be paying attention to it, wants to put their best face forward, you know? And if an artist comes on and he has a week chopped off his deadline because somebody before him screwed up, it's not fair. The guy's going to have to do the best job he can within a deadline that's been truncated, and nobody wants to be known as, oh, he was the bad artist on the book.
Right.
So, you know, there's a lot of factors that go into this, just simply because it is a weekly comic book.
Were you involved with Action Comics Weekly from 15 years ago?
Bob Fleming and I poked around with a Peacemaker story. We got a couple of chapters of that.
I remember
going,
that.
But I was not hands-on involved in it, and it was just sort of a blip. It was just a blip on my radar.
Okay. That's the concern of readers, and, you know, that's that and the Marvel Weekly from the same time period and everything, that was the only example. This obviously is a much different animal because it is one story.
It was one story, but also, again, there's a real solid structure as to how this thing is going to be put together. They've got all sorts of redundancies built in. We're trying to cover every possibility. And, of course, there's something you just can't cover,
mm-hmm.
you know. But, here, people are always asking me, do you think you can pull this off? Do you think you can pull this off? You know, and my answer has always been, look at the talent that we've got involved with this book. You know, look at the writers that are working on it. Look at the artists that are working on it. Look at the way everyone is just really giving 100%. How can we not do it? I mean, it's inconceivable to me that we won't pull this off with the roster of talent that we have.
That's really cool.
And plus, there's always that little goad that always works by telling them, you know, if we screw up issue number 22, we got 30 weeks of embarrassment. Because this unfolds in real time.
Absolutely.
You know, the week of the 4th of July, there's going to be fireworks in the comic, you know? And so if we screw up a deadline and don't make a week, we're 1 week behind, and it would just be humiliating.
That's really terrific. You're going to tie in real-time events to the story as well.
Yeah.
Very
and
cool.
And so far, so good. You know, I'm glad I'm not on that side of, you know, having to go, all right, we're doing week 22. Okay, what's going to happen then? Oh, it's, you know, God knows. It's Arbor Day. What do we do at Arbor Day? I just get the scripts and break them down and you know, smooth off some of the rough edges. So I don't have to worry about, you know, well, how do we fit Christmas in here? That's up to those guys.
Well, this is the end of January when we're talking. Where are you currently in your breakdowns for 52?
I'm starting 11.
Okay. Okay, and this begins in May?
Yes.
Okay.
So you see, it's moving along really nicely. By May, we should have a huge chunk of this already in-house.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's not like we just decided we're going to do a weekly comic and I'll start working on it next week and we'll schedule it for next month. Yeah, this has been very well planned out and put together. I don't know how Steve Wacker's doing it because he's the editor.
Yes.
And he's editing other books other than 52, you know, the flow charts all over his wall and everything. But I'm really glad that he's on board because I think Steve Wacker is one of the a few editors in the business that can actually pull this off.
Wow.
You know, in terms of, he knows how to handle the talent, he's respected by the talent across the board, and he's really meticulous. You know, and I think you need that.
That's really cool. You know, every writer I've spoken to, and now with you, Grant is the only one I haven't spoken to, and all of you guys are speaking really highly of how well Steve is executing everything for 52.
Yeah, it's really good. You know, he keeps everybody in the loop As the artwork comes in, when he has enough, he'll make sure everyone sees it, utilizes email to keep people updated on things. He's the perfect choice. Of course, now I've been working with him for a couple of months, but even so, I find it very hard to imagine any other editor doing quite the job that Steve is doing right now in terms of holding things together and just maintaining. That's what it comes down to. This is a marathon.
And yeah, that's how it's been described to me, a marathon. And also Greg Rucka even said, when it's all done, it's a novel, not a graphic novel, a novel in terms of the dense storytelling you guys are doing.
I don't mean to dump on any other editors up at DC or imply that they would be incapable of doing the job on 52.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying that because of the way he handles the talent, the way that he edits the books, and his attention to detail, Steve Wacker was probably the best choice they could have made for this.
That's really cool. All of you guys have been saying that, and I think that's really great, and it shows that you guys are all on the same page.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's not as if we go months without talking or emailing one another. It really is a consensus thing. You know, if a new character has got to be created, it goes into the communal pot. There were some characters that we needed early on, that Grant Morrison just, you know, suddenly gave us a whole list of these characters, all worked out. Everyone was kind of stunned by that because it seems to have happened overnight, but that's what Grant does.
Wow.
And then in the latest issue, there were another group of characters, and I actually said, let me take a crack at these. So, yeah, everyone's putting in equally. And I guess it is like a band, you know, and I'll admit, even though it's daunting, a weekly comic book, I haven't had this much fun in a long time. And how often do you get to work with all four of DC's top writers at once?
Yeah.
You know, most people are lucky if they bump up against these guys once or twice in their career. I mean, I'm in a real good place. I'm in a lucky place.
That's really cool. Let's talk about the Blue Beetle.
All right.
Because that's coming up. New character, a tie to the original Beetle in Dan Garrett, that he has the Dan Garrett Scarab.
Yeah, this new Blue Beetle... although he's a brand new character, it's a brand new take on the character, it's a whole other animal. We don't just erase everything that's gone before. This isn't a reimagining where you say, oh yeah, all that time you spent being fans of Blue Beetle, waste of time. We're not doing that. Where we're going with Blue Beetle springboards out of both Blue Beetle's history. So, in case anyone thinks we're just going to come in and flame everything out into a white event, that's not going to happen. Oh, and I like to, well, for the record, it's not going to be a wah-ha-ha book. I'm capable of doing more than just vaudeville. Blue Beetle is has its humorous moments, but other than that, as people will find out reading it, it's as serious as a heart attack.
That's really cool. Did you do a lot of research? I mean, you were a reader, I'm guessing, of the Ditko years in Charlton.
Oh, absolutely. I've been a fan of comics since I was 8 years old.
There you go.
I loved Ditko's Blue Beetle stuff. It was, for a while, it was in like a double bang. You were getting the Blue Beetle and the Question in one book.
Mm-hmm.
So I always liked the character, and then when it was a chance to deal with him in Justice League, Mark and I walked in and started, playing a couple of riffs off of him, and it just fits so well. And the new Blue Beetle, again, it has nothing to do with Ted Kord. It has nothing to do with Dan Garrett, but it has a lot to do with the Scarab. It answers a couple of questions that people have been asking. How come when he got the Scarab, Dan Garrett got powers, but Ted didn't?
Mm-hmm.
We get to all of that.
But okay.
It's not done in such a way that you need a doctorate thesis. You have to have written a doctorate thesis on Blue Beetle. It's not a book that insists you know about Blue Beetle history or know what has gone before. It's a perfect jump-on point, and as we reveal things that impact the new Blue Beetle that come out of the past Blue Beetles,
mm-hmm.
We're doing it as if these stories were never told before, so the new reader doesn't have to go hunting down Justice Leagues to see about Ted Kord or Charlton Comics or even the original Blue Beetle. We're trying to really make this a self-contained book.
Okay, because, yeah, I was kind of wondering, just from a curiosity standpoint, because I'm an old-time radio fan, and I was pleased to discover even the Blue Beetle radio show of the 40s that seemed to take from that Victor Fox version of the Beetle.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you ever heard any of those.
I didn't even know he was a radio broadcast.
Yeah, exactly, and it was interesting to see how big the character was back during the Golden Age as well.
The character is maintained through the years. I mean, there's obviously something about the character that's striking a junk culture nerve. And hopefully we can continue it.
That's cool. Was that your design for the new costume?
No, that was Cully.
Okay.
And I'll tell you, he nailed that costume right off the bat. That's with minor variations. That's pretty much the design he came up with.
That's really cool. Yeah, Cully Hammer's a hell of an artist, and that's a neat
and
team.
The stuff he's doing in Blue Beetle is it's like, if we didn't tell you it was Cully, you'd probably have to, you know, look at the credits to be absolutely sure. It's a quantum leap forward for him. It's just gorgeous, gorgeous stuff. I mean, he's telling the story, and all of the emotional resonances are there, and he's nailing the vital moments and just the sense of place. Everything across the board. I mean, you know, Joan Hilty was the one who really championed Cully on the book.
Okay.
And in this case, she was so right.
As an artist that developed into a writer, how do you send your scripts to the new artists that you work with?
I send full scripts.
Okay.
I tend to work with final draft. You know, I utilize the screenplay format,
mm-hmm.
you know, wherein basically the dialogue and the characters would be down the middle of the page, like a screenplay, and then you have the blocks of descriptive copy, setting a place and basically what I need out of the panel. The only rule of thumb I use is I will not ask an artist to draw something I would, maybe coming from drawing comics before I started writing comics, I think I'm a bit more sensitive to the artist's concerns or the artist's needs.
Mm-hmm.
You shouldn't write the charge of the Light Brigade into a story trivially because it's a bitch to draw.
Sure.
You know? And it took me a long time, but the reason I switched over to writing was because it only dawned on me, you know, it's a hell of a lot easier to write the charge of the Light Brigade than it is to draw it.
Yeah, Into the Valley of Death Road, the 600, that took 5 seconds. Now draw it.
That said, I will still ask for scenes, you know, where sometimes it seems a bit overwhelming. But again, I will never write something into a script and hand it to an artist that I wouldn't be willing to draw where the positions reversed.
Do guys ask for breakdowns from you, or do you ever do that yourself?
Oddly enough, lately I've had, I'm not going to go into exactly who.
No, that's okay.
But I've had a couple of guys actually say, you know, could you provide breakdowns? I guess, you know, working on the Justice League and the other books I did up at DC and doing the breakdowns, I don't think it's that the artist, you know, says, oh, I need Keith Sterling breakdowns to make it work. I think it's just the curiosity factor of, you know, would you mind doing breakdowns on this? Because they're just curious about how it would work out.
Sure.
Also, it helps with the deadlines a bit, and I think that's another reason I'm doing the breakdowns for 52. Not only is it artistic consistency, but if I do the breakdowns, the artist doesn't have to worry about breaking down the page, and he can completely focus on drawing.
Right, executing the work.
Yeah, you know, kind of one-third of the job has pretty much been removed, and you know, like you put, yeah, you know, you said, he just has to execute it to the best of his ability, buys him a bit more time to polish it up nicely.
As a writer, which guys were you working with back, you know, when you started in the 70s and stuff? Who would you say were the guys that helped mold you to become the writer that you are now? If any. Maybe not.
Okay. I can point to Carmine Infantino as being the largest influence in terms of how I approach the page as an artist. But when it comes to the writing, believe it or not, it was, for the most part, it was editors. Andy Helfer, you know, it's the way he approached it and always, you know, always encouraging me to, you know, try writing a bit more. You know, you do the breakdowns, you do the plot real good, just put in the dialogue.
That's cool.
His encouragement, also, you know, learning from him. Paul Levitz, of course, working with him on Legion of Superheroes was pretty much a crash course in how to juggle a huge cast and make it work. Ernie Colon,
okay,
who's always been there to you know, help me over whatever artistic hurdle I might need help over. And, of course, the people that I work with, my collaborators, Mark DeMattis, Tom and Mary Beerbohm, Bob Fleming, even learning from John Rogers on this new Blue Beetle book.
Yeah, I should mention John Rogers. We haven't talked about him, and John Rogers,
yeah. Extraordinarily talented guy, one of the sought-after screenwriters in Hollywood. And he likes comics. He's just, you know, it's like he certainly doesn't have to do this. You know, and when he looks at the money he's making doing Blue Beetle as opposed to the money he's making by being cherry-picked by Steven Spielberg to write a project, there's no comparison. You know, it's...
What do you think of that? Because you're an old comics hand, and there are all these new screenwriters that are coming to comics to do their work, and
I'm of two minds of that. On one hand, I love new talent. I don't care where it comes from. I love new talent coming into the field, be it, you know, an artist or a writer or an anchor or even an editor with a different approach to getting the books out. I really think it keeps the field fresh, and it keeps me on my toes. I love competing with them. But on the other hand, when you have guys, if you're making money hand over fist in Hollywood doing TV or screenwriting, and somebody calls you and says, would you like to do a comic book, and you say yes, what are you going to say? If you want to do it, by all means, do it. My problem is that sometimes the companies will overlook the comic book writers looking to grab a name that they can slap on the cover, like, you know, from the creator of this and such, or from the guy who wrote this movie. And that's what becomes problematic for me. And, you know, you've got a wide range of extraordinarily talented writers in comics, a lot of whom are just getting work on a piecemeal basis. And maybe you should look to them, because these are the guys that kept this business alive and vital for so many years.
Certainly.
Before you go looking outside. But, yeah, I can't really blame them. I mean, you know, it's if you can land the guy that did Buffy the Vampire Slayer, he brings a lot of junk culture credibility with him.
Yeah, and I think he loves the books that he's writing, too.
Yeah. So, you know, it's like, it isn't as if I look at it and go, oh, these Hollywood writers are picking our jobs. You know, it's just,
no, I understand.
You know, I don't see it that way. I see it as, you know, they're new in the business. And, again, it's people I can compete with or even learn from if I bump up against them in a collaborative manner. I just wish that sometimes, in some projects, I really wish that their first inclination wasn't to go outside of the comic book field to grab a writer.
No, I understand.
You know, and I don't begrudge any of these guys any of the work they're getting, because, you know, you can, like this guy, Josh Whedon.
Mm-hmm.
That's the guy, I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah, Buffy, and he had a whole bunch of stuff under his belt, but I can guarantee if he handed in a bad comic, he was going to get more work.
Absolutely. And there have been guys from Hollywood that have come in and have been rapped for their bad work, and they're not writing comic books anymore.
Yeah. A lot of people think that comics and movies are akin. You know, I don't see why more comic book people aren't writing movies and vice versa. They're completely different disciplines. You know, with comics, in film, you are writing linear. You are writing, it's for action, it's for movement, it's linear. Whereas in comics, you are isolating scenes.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's going to sound kind of weird, but the white space between the panels is as important as what the panel features. It's kind of like going through an entire movie and doing a picture book, and you can only pull out certain frames. And those frames have to not only tell what's going on in the story, but move the reader or the viewer on to the next frame. They're not as similar as a lot of people would think. The only similarity is that both traffic in words and pictures.
It sounds like you agree with a lot of what Scott McCloud says in his texts about understanding comics. And I don't know if you've read those.
Yeah, I have. I read Scott's book, and yeah, I agree with a lot of what Scott says.
That's cool.
Yeah, you know, I think there's a... I think there might be an attitude out there on behalf of guys working in other fields, whether they're best-selling novelists or top-tier screenwriters or producers or guys who write for television,
mm-hmm.
that comics will be just easy money, roll off a log, I do this, I have beer and pizza money. And they're usually kind of surprised to find out that it's a whole other discipline.
Sure.
They're as similar as film and TV and comics are. I really think that there's more that they don't have in common, a lot more that they don't have in common, and that's what certain people have a trouble understanding. It's the same reason, it's the same thing happens when some comic book guys go to film. You know, they're not used to writing that flow, so they tend to isolate incidents. You know, it's just a discipline. Aikido is not karate, it's not jujitsu. You know?
Absolutely.
It's a different discipline. So, you know, I guess that's probably the best way to put it.
Have you tried to do any Hollywood stuff, either storyboarding or scripting?
I did a lot of storyboarding. I did storyboarding for Batman Beyond for Batcher episodes. I was
that's great.
Storyboarding for the first two seasons of Static Shock. I wrote two episodes of Ed, Edd n Eddy.
Oh, very cool.
One of which is in constant rotation. So yeah, I've done the animation stuff. I've done a couple of spec screenplays and gotten the usual amount of disinterested interest. But it's, again, sitting down to write that spec screenplay, when I look at the first one I ever wrote, and I keep it in my machine as a reminder, you know, you're so great, read this piece of crap. It's a learning process. It took me about 2 years to understand the rhythms of a screenplay or a teleplay.
Now, you've worked then with those guys at Warner, with Static Shock and Batman Beyond.
Yeah.
I just had Dwayne McDuffie on about a month ago.
Dwayne's a great guy.
Dwayne's
one of the good guys.
Absolutely. And those shops, I think, have produced such great animation and have, you know, really understood the spirit of, you know, what made comic books great and really translated it well into cartoons in a way that it was never done before.
Well, yeah, and there's a certain amount of respect for the source material, but there's also got to be a certain amount of disrespect for the source material because it is a different genre.
Yes.
A lot of the changes that are made in cartoons or in movies to the characters are dictated just by the medium they're working in. It was okay for Adam West to run around in the Batman suit as we know it. But if you want to reach a much broader audience and not be camp about it, you got to jack it up a little bit.
Sure.
You know, it takes different approaches for different mediums. But the Justice League guys, yeah, I agree with you that they've come about as close as you can come to really just animating a comic book.
Yeah. Now, it's funny because, you know, you make the Adam West comparison. I wasn't going to even ask you this, but it brings to mind the failed Justice League pilot that seemed to take a page. I gotta go there because I'm just curious. Obviously, that's a good reaction to tell me what you think of it. But yeah, what did they start with your guys' stuff?
I sat in a couple of meetings with some producers or the guys that were then trying to pull this together,
mm-hmm.
and they, to their benefit, they were really trying to capture the comic book and do it in as dignified a manner as possible, considering the restrictions of budget, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure.
But, you know, the best laid plans, when Justice League came out, I don't know how many rewrites it went through. I didn't notice it was the same guys. And it nosedived, didn't it? And I think the worst thing that happened to that Justice League pilot was the Flash TV show took off.
Yeah, that's true.
Everyone's got to look like a Flash. It was a misfire of cosmic proportions. It makes the Roger Corman Fantastic Four thing look like gold. You know?
Yeah, well, poor David Ogden Stiers, you know, Charles Winchester from
MASH. Oh, that was hysterical.
As the Martian Manhunter.
Oh, yeah. And it's kind of like these ridiculous shots, like I think at one point Fire is actually doing something critical to helping him win. And she looks at the camera and smiles like she's, you know, vamping for the Miss America judges. Didn't work for me, man.
No.
Didn't work.
There's a reason why it's in the bootleg bin, I understand.
Yeah, it's an interesting curiosity piece. But boy, could you possibly have done it any worse?
Well, now you guys have just wrapped up the Defenders, and
Victory finally came out. Yay!
Yeah, and great story, man. Really great. And I hope that means. And I had heard Mark on other interviews, things like Fanboy Radio, where he had said that you guys are going to do another miniseries.
Marvel seems amenable. Nothing's been nailed down yet.
Okay.
But Marvel does seem amenable, and it's just a matter of can we find the right time, place, and people to do it. You know, if Defenders continues, will it be me, Mark, and Kevin again? Will it be me and Mark? We don't know who's going to be busy. We don't know when Marvel's going to want it. So it is kind of up in the air. Yes, Marvel would like to continue the Defenders, but no, I'm not quite sure when they'll want to actually start on it or under what conditions it'll be coming out.
Okay, you know, and we always hear in interviews with you or Mark about the two of you, and we shouldn't forget about Kevin, because Kevin really, you know, does a great job as well, and I think brings to life a lot of your guys' ideas. How does the artwork then between you and Kevin?
Look, I just hand in the plot, and sometimes Mark will do dialogue off of my plot, and then Kevin will be handed the full script, and he draws it. Sometimes he'll work off of my plot. I don't see, sometimes they'll send it to me, but 9 times out of 10, I don't really see the artwork until it's published. I see it when you see it.
Okay.
I don't read Mark's dialogue either, because this way I can sit down and read the Defenders as a fan. I'm not paging through it going, oh, man, I've read this 20 times already. Just shoot me. Like on Hero Squared. I don't read Hero Squared until you do.
That's cool. And yeah, I do want to talk about your boom work, because I really did enjoy Hero Squared and Planetary Brigade is also great. And 10 as well. So I want to talk about the boom stuff, but first on the Defenders, quickly, because I do love all the interesting comedic conceits you gave to all the characters, but particularly the surfer with the surfers was fantastic. And it's so funny, because there's something so obvious that it's amazing that it's taken so long for someone to say, "Hi, Silver Surfer, why don't you put him with the Dick Dale crowd?"
I'm sure that the idea has cropped up more than once, but I think Creature has a bad taste to actually do it. I think the high point of the five-issue Defender thing is we got the Hulk lead.
Absolutely.
If anything, it has ensured us a perverse little place in comic book history. Look, Defenders was just this is Mark and I dragging Kevin along and putting on our red noses and the baggy pants, and away we go.
It's great, and the tradition continues with your Boom Studio stuff with Hero Squared and Planetary Brigade. That's again another neat idea, because like any superhero cipher group, there are allusions to iconic characters that everyone can recognize.
Yeah.
But I also like the fact that you guys, especially with Hero Squared, have injected that kind of the way new comic books are made today, and the independent comic books, where you've got kind of the slacker guy who suddenly discovers this, alternate universe version of himself who's Superman.
Well, Hero Squared was a vague idea I had way back when about, what if there was a knock on the door and you opened it and it's you in a superhero suit? And it just sort of springboarded from there. When I talked to Ross Ritchie about it, he really liked the idea. And, bringing Mark on board, well, that was a natural. And, just running with it from there. Ross Ritchie dug up Joe Abraham. And we haven't looked back. The good thing about Hero Squared is it's Mark and I unfiltered.
Yes.
We don't have to worry about soiling a character.
Right.
That was a big thing on Justice League. Oh, you can't use that character, you'll soil him. The rules of Justice League were really, really easy. When he walks in the door of the embassy, we're going to have a bit of fun with him. But when he walks out, we'll return him in the same shape he was when he came in. In the meantime, we'll have a bit of fun with him.
Absolutely.
We'll have a bit of fun with a character. And a lot of people look upon it as, they just make fun of the characters. And that's true. Yeah, we do. But it's not done with malice. I don't think we could do the kind of stories that we do in Justice League or Hero Squared if we didn't have some form of affection for the characters, And listen, on Justice League, I was always more interested in Ted and Beatrice and Guy than I was in Blue Beetle and Fire and Green Lantern.
Who was Mary Marvel's character in the revamp?
I asked for Supergirl.
Okay.
And I guess we couldn't have him for whatever reason. I think we're just nervous about the fact she's just been launched and we might soil her. And when I asked for Mary Marvel, look, nobody was more surprised than I was when they gave Mary Marvel to us.
Because you soiled the hell out of Mary Marvel.
One thing I couldn't do that I wanted to do was I actually wanted her to lose her virginity and show up the next day in the red costume.
I hadn't heard about that,
That didn't go anywhere. That was no way.
But that's the beauty of Planetary Brigade, where you can do these things.
Yeah. And keep in mind, when we first walked in with the whole idea of a formless Justice League, as far as I was concerned, Mary Marvel was going to fill the void left by Ice.
Mm-hmm.
But she launched into her own character,
Yeah, just this gushing, innocent girl.
Yeah. I mean, put on a coffee jag.
Yeah.
Having Guy Garner inappropriately touch her. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff going on in there with that character. And by the end, we suddenly realize, she's not the Ice replacement. She's this a fully developed character in her own right.
And also,
I don't think we soiled her.
Well, it was the alternate universe when they got soiled. That's okay.
Truth to tell. Okay.
But it's great because I think the Marvels, the Fawcett Marvels, are so tough to write because everyone has the memory. The best that they ever were during those C.C. Beck and Otto Binder years of comedy and lighthearted stories. And I think it's tough to put them in today's world. And luckily, I think you guys, in both versions in the 80s with Captain Marvel and this version with Mary Marvel, you guys had the right tone of comedy, but still respectful to the characters.
Yeah, well, that's the idea. Because, again, we weren't interested in Mary Marvel as much as we were interested in Mary Batson. I don't know.
Mary Batson.
And once you understand who the character is, the powers just become something that you can riff off of. And some of our favorite issues, to go back to Justice League,
sure,
are the ones where nothing really happened. And that's even not too good. Nobody threw a punch. Just because you don't throw a punch doesn't mean there's not a lot of shit happening in a book.
Sure.
But in terms of Justice League, in terms of Justice League America, we're pretty much unanimous that Moving Day is the story we all really like a lot. In Justice League Europe, it's the French lesson.
I was going to ask about the French lesson, because I love that one too.
Yeah, but the annual Justice League Antarctica, I think, was where everything just came together to tell the kind of story. Right. And plus, I love penguins. and the kind of books that Mark and I do, the way we deal with the characters, it's the down moments that I think become more interesting than the running out and beating up a villain. You know, I don't know any other superhero team that could have gotten away with having two of their members go on a date to the Ice Capades. I was so proud when I came up with Guy Gardner on ice, by the way. You know?
But
once you set up something like that, and once the fans and the readers are bought into it, there's no limit to the amount of fun you can have. And Hero Squared is a sort of, and Planetary Brigade is sort of us just continuing that, but we don't have to worry about, returning Captain Marvel to the DC universe because he's got to appear over here, or you can't do that with so and so because back in his history he stubbed his toe on Thursday. we can just do whatever we want with the characters. And Hero Squared, again, I think it's more about the dynamic between Milo, Captain Valor, Steffi, and Caligonus than it is about putting on a cape and beating people up.
I gotcha.
And Planetary Brigade is basically, we're known for a superhero team. Let's create our own.
And it's a great team. I read the first issue. I haven't read the second yet, but it's great because, again, recognizable ciphers, but you can do whatever the hell you want with them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like, well, you start off with the recognizable ciphers. Like, it's obvious. Grim Knight is the Batman guy.
Certainly.
Eventually, we might explore the fact that, his kid sidekicks never last more than 6 months. there might have been 20 of them so far. Captain Valor is obviously Superman.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest, we started off with, the Muav visitor is John Jones. But all of a sudden, he became Truman Capote. and Earth Goddess, well, she was, and they sort of launch into different directions, and that's where the fun really is. Fun comes into it when you figure, you started off as a Batman clone, but man, you're nowhere near Batman now.
Is Earth Goddess kind of an amalgam between like a Wonder Woman and a Mary Marvel?
She's kind of an amalgam between a Wonder Woman, She-Hulk, Metamorpho.
Sure.
Every superhero group has the members and the big guy standing in the background.
Mm-hmm.
There's always that. There's Reed, Sue, Johnny, thing in the background, big guy. And Earth Goddess was basically our big guy in the background.
That's cool.
And just trying to take the icons, the iconic characters, and say, here's another way to look at them. Dr. Strange. Okay, what if it's a chick? What if she's got a third eye? Boom, we're running.
Yeah.
And that's what's fun to me. I would much rather come up with something completely new than try to fix something that's been badly damaged.
Other than the handcuffs being off in terms of what you can and can't do with these Boom Studio characters.
Up to a point. Ross has lines that he won't cross.
Okay.
Like I'm never going to get the character Cubic Justice in there. I want to. I've mentioned her before. She has Medusa's powers, but down here.
I should mention, by the way, the filters are off here as well, so feel free to express yourself as clearly as possible.
Yeah, so that's not going to happen. Ross is not just Give us carte blanche. He's called down a couple of things and gone, what are you doing? You know, but I'll tell you, it is a reason we're at Boom.
Well, that's great, and I think it's a win-win for both of you.
Yeah, well, it kind of, I hope it's a win-win for both of us. Here was square with something Mark and I really want to do. Ross Ritchie wanted to start a comic book company. Ross Ritchie wants to start a comic book company that published comics. We own Hero Squared Lock, Stock, and Barrel. Ross has no rights to it at all. He didn't even take 1%.
Wow.
He publishes, he makes his money off of that. Boom is fast becoming what Image was supposed to have been. It's like, if you come to him with this character, and you've got this book, and it's yours, and he wants to publish it, he'll publish it. You don't have to sign up. How insidious is it? You go to a company with something bled and sweat to put down on the page, and they go, okay, we'll publish it, but we get 50% of it. Hey,
sure.
Fuck you!
I was wondering, because I remember you had something from Image just a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that was Dominion. It's Ross.
Yes, yes.
It's Ross of all things.
Oh, okay.
You know,
there you go. So you guys took it instead and then created
I fixed it with Image, and I didn't mean to sound like, you know, I was dumping on Image when I said that Boom is fast becoming what Image was meant to be in terms of Image was first formed as a creative coalition where you put your books out there.
Yes.
And you own the rights and blah, blah, blah. I think that was undermined the first time they generated a work-for-hire contract.
Sure, sure.
But whereas with Boom, it's like you get your creative freedom, you get to own your characters, and you can relax, or at least I can relax, because I know that Ross is meticulous enough that he's going to see to it that these books look as good as is humanly possible. You know, Boom hasn't put out a dog book yet.
Yeah.
Even on, look, and Ken.
I wanted to talk about
Ken like a mental patient.
Yeah.
Because I'm looking for the mistake. There's always a mistake. There's always a word balloon going to the wrong person or a misspell. And 10 is a perfect 10.
10's a great book.
It's as close as I've ever come to having everything I want on the page. The right artist, the right colorist. It looks great. It's nailed it across the board. How can you not want to work with a company like that, that cares as much about your book as you do? And not because they're going to go running off and sell it for film rights and get 50% of your money, but because they care about publishing quality comics and ours.
It's great. And 10 is as far from the Justice League, Hero Squared, Planetary Brigade stuff that you do, and reminds people that you're not just wah-ha-ha. You do good grit, and you do tough stories. And that's a very tough story, and I think you and Andy Kuhn executed a great story.
Well, the funny thing is, all the criticisms of 10 are the ones I wanted in there. Like, people going, well, how could it be random if it was his girlfriend? And my take on it is, what made you think they were telling the truth when they invited you to the contest?
Mm-hmm.
The entire theme of 10 is summed up in one sentence. Nothing more horrifying than random. Random is horror.
Yep.
And it was, to me, it was a line drive down the middle, nasty little story that I had to get out of my head. It's funny that people only think of me in terms of wah-ha-ha when I've done a 5-year-later Legion. That was not very funny.
No, and brilliant.
I did Mars Attacks.
Yes.
First miniseries. I've trafficked in books that aren't meant to be funny. But majority of them kind of are tongue-in-cheek funny. But like to look at Peter David and go, oh, he couldn't write a superhero book unless he put humor in it. No, Peter's quite capable of writing dead-on serious stuff, and I'm sure that he could scare the shit out of you if
sure.
he put his mind to it, if he
sure.
wanted to. For a while, every time I got on a book, it was, oh, no, he's going to make it funny. I think people started moving out of that he's only funny when I started doing the English adaptation of Battle Royale.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that because there are a lot of similarities between 10 and Battle Royale.
Yeah, 10 was birthed out of the Battle Royale idea of just people trapped in people chosen at random in bad circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
With 10, I left a lot of questions open. I left a lot of the one thing that everyone's missing, and I left a lot of clues. Maybe I was too subtle, but. Every reason they go, well, how does the guy, the black guy, know so much about the contest? Well, listen to what he's saying. I've been down this road before. Jesus, he's the last contest winner. You know,
yes.
I wanted 10 to be something wherein you only get the information that Graham gets. The odds are, if you are one of four people to survive a nuclear holocaust, out of the three people you're with, the odds are that one of them is not, it's not going to be a nuclear physicist among the bunch. You know, it's like, oh no, the grass has come to life and is eating us, and you're trapped in a basement with a botanist. Hey, how handy. People die without ever knowing reasons why, and that to me is horror. That terrifies me, the fact that you know, there are people wandering around out there just choosing victims at random. You know, and with 10, I tried to push that forward.
I think it was a good story. It reminds me of a couple things in a good way. Not derivative, but certainly in the same genre. Series 7,
yeah,
an independent movie, and also a British comic book that came out a few years ago, Button Man, The Killing Game. It was a John Wagner comic book.
I never heard of it. Yeah.
And no, those it really worked, and it is. It's a great one-shot, and I recommend people to go seek it out because...
It's all it was meant for. I'm never going to return to those characters again. There's no sequel. There's no background. Although I had a perverse thought that somewhere down the line on Hero Squared, that Milo gets a box in the mail.
Oh, that's cool.
But as it stands right now, 10 was just a one-shot. I had to get the story out of my head.
I got you.
It was like I did this story called Trigger and the Man for a Taboo, Steve Bissett's now-defunct horror anthology.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It was another one of those nasty little stories I just had to get out of my head.
Well,
you know, I don't sit around watching The Three Stooges all the time. I'm a huge Grindhouse horror fan.
That's, hey, are you going to, did you see Hostel, or are you going to see
Hostel? Yeah.
Oh, really? Was it disappointing?
For me, yes.
Okay.
I expected more of it, and this is, again, just me. It's just me. You know, it struck me as being like, you know, Euro trip by way of the Japanese guinea pig genre.
Yeah.
And I was just like, yeah, let me just say, by the time they started working these kids over, I wanted them dead.
See, I was just in Amsterdam like 5 years ago, and that's why I'm like, you know, this sounds like it'll be fun. And I talked to Jimmy Palmiotti earlier this week, and he was saying it was good. So now I got to balance between the two of you because I respect both of your tastes.
It's just, you know, it just with me, I was just going, you know, oh God, just kill them, kill them. You know, I have no sympathy for these people. Just kill them. It's, you know, we're, oh my God, our Icelandic friend that we've known for all of a week is missing. Let's go get him. No, he's not even a drive to the airport friend yet. He's certainly not. He's missing. Let's go hunting for him, friend.
So, and is there any recent film?
Oh God.
Yeah, I know. That like, you know, really did kind of hit that part of your brain that appreciates the grindhouse kind of mentality.
Audition.
Okay.
Eekus film. Current. Oh boy.
Anything. You can reach back if you want to.
I'm trying to think. I like some of the Japanese horror stuff. I really liked Audition. I liked Ichi the Killer,
mm-hmm.
Dead or Alive. Those are Miike films.
Why do they try to remake those into American films?
Because the American junk culture landscape is barren. Because they're cowards. People running the media they're a cowardly, superstitious lot.
Thank you, Bruce. Okay.
You know, it's like we're talking the mindset of a bunch of people who thought remaking Bewitched.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
It's, you know, it's the kind of people. Hollywood is run by the kind of people who are still buying SUVs.
Yeah.
You know, the gas prices are going up, and then they'll when I see people driving on these big gas-guzzling SUVs, I just think, I hope the price of gas goes up $5 a gallon, just so I can watch these bastards bleed.
I think there's a reason why I like your stuff,
then. It just drives me crazy, and you know, it's like, I look at it, I don't want to see another Batman movie. I don't want to see another Spider-Man movie, or I've seen Friday the 13th, 27. What the fuck is that?
Did you not like the Batman movie?
I did. I haven't seen it.
Oh, okay.
I want to watch. I don't want to see another Batman movie. I just don't want to. I don't want to see another Spider-Man movie. I don't want to see another X-Men movie. Friday 13th. But enough. No, give me something. One movie I really liked. I liked the Fantastic Four film.
Did you? Okay.
And I sat there and I walked out of the theater. My daughter looked at me kind of odd going, you probably didn't like that at all. I went, no, I really loved it because... That movie was inked by Dick Ayers.
Oh, that's interesting.
It perfectly captured the first year of the FF. You know, when we would go, I got to build this atomic thermostat. Boink, next panel, it's there. Well, here he was going, I'll build a machine to, boink, it's there. It was the perfect this is boiling down of that first year of FF, and they throw in the stupid ass shit.
Sure.
That things the kids like, oh, let's put Johnny in a dirt bike competition.
See, now I didn't see that because I heard all the bad things about Fantastic Four, so this is interesting to hear.
No, if you go in realizing that it's meant to be a fluff piece.
Sure.
If you go in figuring it's meant to be a fluff piece, you'll pretty much be okay.
That's cool.
You know? So I kind of enjoyed it. Would I recommend it? No. You know, because I'm trying to think of the last movie I wholeheartedly recommended. Elephant.
I didn't see Elephant.
It's I think it was made for H, for cable or something like that. It's Gus Van Sant's really disturbing take on kids who bring guns to school.
Oh, wow. And I do like...
Very disturbing piece of work.
When he's not remaking Hitchcock, I do like Gus Van Sant.
I saw this, and first I was astonished he made it. I was even more astonished that somebody would actually agree to show it. Because it is kind of... It is merciless.
Wow.
And so that was kind of interesting. But, it's really hard for me to leave the house to go see a movie because I always walk out feeling like I screwed out at $8.
Yeah, I hear you. $8, that's cheap.
Well, around here, it's just some... You know, you go to the third run theater.
Now, you said that 10 was a story you had to get out. I wonder, because you mentioned Legion 5 years later, which I do love.
Yeah.
And was that not in response to the years you spent with Levitz, because clearly that was great work. But, yeah, I mean, was that kind of a story that you had buried that you're like, well, there's no way that Paul would ever tell this story?
No. It was when Karen Berger approached me and said, you know, Paul's leaving the Legion. Would you like to take over? We're thinking of starting it over from one, blah, blah, blah. I knew the kind of story I wanted to tell, and I knew where I wanted to go. I knew the theme I wanted to explore, and that is, you know, these Legionnaires can be heroes even when it's all going against them. It's pretty easy to be a hero when you're living in these fancy digs and you have groupies. You know, but what happens when it's all going wrong? So I needed to really tear down the UP universe.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to actually do that, like, on screen. So I bumped it 5 years later, figuring all this bad stuff happened during the 5 year later thing. And I'll revisit certain of the key points, but by bumping it 5 years later, it would mean that Paul's run on the book and all that had gone before with the Legion was intact. Legion fans would not feel as if I was completely disposing of years and years and years of continuity. Yeah, you've loved the Legion for 30 years, more fool you. I wanted to, you know, respect that. And, of course, then later on we had to do the white event and it all hit the fan. And then we were scrambling like crazy just to salvage as much of Legion as we could. But the five-year later gap was pretty much I did not want Paul... didn't want it to look like I was systematically undoing Paul had ever, everything Paul had ever done.
Sure.
I wanted to bump it 5 years later and take it from Grimm and see the resurgence of the Legion of Superheroes and eventually bring them back to the level Paul left them on.
They haven't traded that, have they? That's too bad because, man, that's such a great story.
Well, the original idea with the Legion of Superheroes was that, and of course it got when I finally threw up my hands and figured I can't deal with this anymore. The original idea was that there would be a huge war to free Earth from the Dominion, wherein it would be revealed that the SW8 batch, the young kids, are the real Legion of Superheroes. They were replaced way back when. The adult Legion that I've been playing with all along were actually like a Manchurian candidate.
I gotcha.
And during the war, some Legionnaires would die on both sides, and we just picked names out of a hat. That was a true rumor.
Wow.
So if I picked out Cosmic Boy, Saturn Girl, Lightning Lad, they're dead.
Wow.
And this way, there would be no favorite. I have favorite Legionnaires. Everyone has a favorite Legionnaire, and this way we would remove that. We might have to kill our favorite. When the dust settled, Earth would be free. The UP would start rebuilding itself. The SW8 batch would be the Legion of Superheroes now, and I would give the fans back the Legion of Superheroes that they've always wanted back. The kids, the clubhouse, the bright, happy future.
Right, the innocents.
The survivors of my book would leave the Legion of Superheroes book and go to the very limits of known space in the universe,
mm-hmm.
and it would become the last bastion of law and order before unknown space, and they would call themselves the Omega Men.
There you go.
That was the ultimate plan, to get two books going, Legion of Superheroes and Omega Men.
Wow.
Use the name. But, of course, you know, it never happened, and I got pissed off, and threw a temper tantrum and blew up the Earth. I wish I could have had plans for that, but no, that was just me being a dick.
And that tied into, that idea ties into the 89 Legion then.
Legion 89 was, after we were done with Invasion, there were no books spinning off the tail end of it. And, you know, Andy Helfer's going from office to office going, come on, doesn't anyone want to spin off of this? But they were all, yeah, everyone was pissed off at us anyway because we introduced the Paragene. How dare you introduce a sweeping concept like that? And I was thinking, well, then don't use it. Who cares? It was the most important, non-essential thing ever introduced in DC. If you want to use it, use it. If you don't, ignore it. It doesn't matter.
Sure.
So Legion 89 and whatever books came out of the tail end, Justice League Europe, came out of the end of the Invasion, were basically me and Andy just putting books together and getting them on sale so we'd have some books come out of the tail end of it because nobody was lining up. It was like one of these special events that, you know, you look back on it now and go, hey, it's not that bad. But back then, you know, Invasion did not make me the most popular guy at DC.
Well, you know, Bendis was saying that's the problem with event books, obviously. Having everyone on board with what you're doing, will you follow through?
Which we talked about earlier, right? You know, it's like you need somebody like a Dan DiDio to sit down and go, no, you're going to do it this way.
Right.
Up until this point, you have to do it this way because I need this to happen so that we can then end it and have this kind of a DC universe which is open to diversity. Here's the ironic part of the whole Crisis 52 thing. At the tail end, the DC universe that exists after they're all over is a DC universe that would be my Justice League could operate in. But they're dead!
Sorry, man.
You know, it does bode well for the comic book reader and the comic book fan that once all the smoke is settled, so the diversity of DC's product is going to be there. There's going to be all sorts of different takes on books and stuff, and the reins are going to be loosened. They just had to be tightened to get us to this point. And yeah, Invasion, people didn't want to play, we couldn't use this character, oh, don't do this, and everyone's pissed off, and Todd McFarlane just spins off into some reality that's completely his.
Was that for Infinity?
It was just, you know, every time we turned around, there was a fire having to be put out on that thing. God!
Jeez.
We brought Bart Sears on to save the deadline. It was one of those things where, and I look at the end result and I go, wow, you know, the fact that it came off at all is a miracle.
That seems to be the challenge with these events. So that's...
The challenge with the event book is how to make... I'm just going to use character names here at random. I'm not dumping on any company.
No problem.
The challenge with the event book is to how to make Captain America fighting Wolverine, again, interesting and fresh.
Certainly.
Because, you know, it's like, okay, this is an event book. It's called Green Card, and all the aliens are picked up by immigration and sent home to their planets. And we'll have Silver Surfer versus The Thing. Been there, done that. You know, this event book is either going to significantly alter the status quo or introduce new characters into the status quo. Then really just do it in the body of the regular book. I mean, Galactus wasn't a special die-cut, square-bound story. It just happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, now you're gearing up for, and obviously already working on, Annihilation.
Yeah.
And that is your big Marvel cosmic event. Was that your idea, or did Joe Q come to you and say, we want you in on this
deal? None of the above. Andy Schmidt, the editor of the project, has always had a real soft spot for the Marvel cosmic characters. And even when I was doing Thanos and Drax,
mm-hmm.
He would always be, you know, just do an event with all the cosmic characters, make them cool again. And then it's a snowball that, you know, you're just gassing with the editor and ideas flip back and forth. And eventually it formed into Annihilation. And that was one of the few projects I've ever been involved with that I could really say was editor-driven.
Okay.
It started with editor-driven. And the great thing, you know, everyone's bitching and moaning about Annihilation. It's the same format as the miniseries. Obviously, we can't use that format anymore without people whining about it. But the thing in Annihilation that makes it different from all the other ones, like people pointing to Seven Soldiers, bunch of miniseries with bookends. Oh, we've been there. We've done that. No, you haven't. I do the Annihilation prologue. There are four miniseries. I'm doing Silver Surfer. There are other guys doing the other characters.
Yes.
And the Annihilation series that follows up on it, I pick up where these other creators have left off to work it into the Annihilation series. So it's not just everyone is doing what Keith says or what Keith set up. When the Nova miniseries is done, I'm handed Nova, and I have to go with what they did. It makes it more of a challenge, and I think it makes it just that much more interesting because it's not... one person generating the ideas.
That's cool.
And again, kudos to Andy Smith. This wouldn't happen if it wasn't for Andy. It wouldn't be in this form if it wasn't for Andy. It's the one time I can honestly say I'm working with a creative editor instead of just a standard editor.
Compare the two in terms of working with the other writers to what you've done on 52 then.
52, I'm working intimately with the writers.
Okay.
Annihilation. I do the prologue, I hand it off.
Mm-hmm.
I'm aware of what they're doing. We touch base every so often, but I barely communicate with the other writers because they're telling their stories.
Gotcha.
And I think it's important that Annihilation be that way because you don't have to buy everything with the Annihilation seal on it to get a good story. If you just like the Super Scroll, you can buy the 4 issues of the Super Scrolls miniseries,
mm-hmm.
and get a beginning, a middle, and an end, and you can walk away. I think once you've read the Super Scroll, the background noise will be interesting enough to propel you into Annihilation, but it's not necessary.
Okay. Do you guys, when executing this, look at what DC did with all the miniseries
No.
that led up to Crisis?
No.
Because, you know, there were some readers did feel like, even though that same, you know, statement was made, they do feel like, well, you say we didn't have to read that, but we kind of feel like we did. I read everything, so it didn't matter to me. I was happy to read everything.
You don't have to read everything there is on World War II to be able to understand and enjoy a story about a platoon set in a village.
Okay.
The Bridge at Remagen.
Mm-hmm.
That's a beginning, middle, and end event that took place within the greater tapestry of the World War II.
I get you.
So, you know, you don't have to know everything that's going on. As long as you know there's a cosmic war going on, then you follow the Super Scroll. And amid the backdrop of this war, he's telling a beginning, middle, and end story. I don't think it's really fair, especially with the price of comics nowadays, to come out with a special event and say, and you have to buy these other 8 books to understand what's going on. That's not an event book. That's bait and switch.
No, I hear you. And I'm glad to hear you say that because, yeah, I think readers are more comforted when they realize that the writers get it, too, in terms of, yeah, it is $3 a book now.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm always aware of the price point on the book. I think that with the price of a comic book now, I could never do a decompressed comic. I don't understand, A, how they're getting away with doing those, and B, why the fans embrace it to that point. I mean, isn't the idea to have a comic book that it takes longer to read the comic than it does to take a dump?
Ideally.
You know? You got it. It's like a $2.95 price tag. Give them something. You know, fill it to the extent that you can. Don't just give them the bone. Put some meat on it. You get an entire issue of a book, and it's the entire issue is the guy walking across the room. Something's wrong. It's really, really, something's wrong. I'll ask you one: do these readers want to read? Is a comic supposed to be just this bang, bang, bang kind of visual fix, and they can move on to the video game? Because I really don't get it. I have no idea what the appeal of what people are calling decompressed comics. I don't see the appeal. I don't understand it. You know, I'm paying $2.95, and 5 minutes later, I'm done?
I'm with you.
Yeah, so with Annihilation, with the other stuff, we're at least trying to, you know, do the opposite of a decompressed a comic, and that is, you know, fill it with stuff and make sure that, you know, the environment and the characters are deeply immersive and they reward repeated visits. Whether we succeed or not,
we'll find out.
You know, and Annihilation does not traffic in the illusion of change either. Trust me, when we're done, the status quo is gone.
Yeah, I've read articles, and you've said that there are going to be characters that people got used to that aren't going to be around anymore.
Mm-hmm. They're not going to be around, or they'll have grown. Events will have forced them into actions they might not normally have taken. Annihilation is the basic premise of Annihilation is to take these cosmic characters and remind the fans why they're cool. You know,
sure.
Silver Surfer's cool. Here, let us prove it. You know, Super Skrull. Great character. Let us prove it. And then just, you know, roll out some hopefully rip-roaring stories, and then it's in the hands of the fans. 52 is the same way. I mean, I'm enjoying reading 52. I look forward to sitting down and reading the script before I do the breakdowns, because it's dense with story, and it's moving forward at a nice clip. you know, and it does have that, wow, I wonder what's going to happen next feel to it. So, well, who knows? You know, it'd be nice. It'd be nice if I had, you know, these two projects flew, you know.
We're rooting for both of them, man. Before we wrap up, I just want to real fast reach back on two other things that I just love. First of all, Hex. I really appreciated the weirdness of throwing Jonah Hex into the future, and I thought it was a really cool run.
Hex, I don't have much to say about, to be honest with you. Hex was, I needed work. They offered the assignment. I did it.
Okay.
I would love to be able to say that, you know, I had an affection for the character, or that there was this desire on my part to explore this post-apocalyptic future, but it was I got rent to pay.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
No.
I'm really cold-hearted, but sometimes it comes down to that.
I respect that. That's okay. The other thing was going to be Lobo. You know, everyone loves Lobo. And I'm curious, first, what do you thought of Brad Garrett from Everybody Loves Raymond being the voice of Lobo on the cartoons?
I didn't even know that.
Oh, no kidding.
I found out Lobo was on the cartoon one Saturday morning when my daughter walked into my studio and said, come here, you might want to look at this. Lobo is a character that I originally created as an indictment of the dark, grim, gritty, vicious, violent superheroes doing reprehensible things, but still calling themselves heroes.
I remember, yeah.
And it got out of hand. He became the poster boy. And I remember doing. I remember on Lobo's back. I was already getting really tired of the character, and I said to Giordano, I said, "I'm going to keep pushing and pushing and pushing, and then when you make me change something, I'm going to leave the book." And Dick was like, "Yeah, don't worry, you're not going to." He didn't believe me. He didn't think I'd really push that hard. And in the third issue of Lobo's back, or one of these, third or fourth, when he's attacking Heaven.
Okay.
There is a scene where he runs across Torquemada and the Inquisitors of Doom. That was not what was originally in the plot. What was originally in the plot was Combat Christ and the Howling Apostles.
Wow.
They yanked it out. I left.
Wow.
And before you start thinking it was some kind of artistic thing, no, I was looking for a reason to leave. I don't think I could have stood doing a monthly Lobo book. A, in order to do the monthly Lobo book, and have it be part of DC Universe, would have had to be watered down significantly.
Sure, sure.
And B, even if I could have done it with the same over-the-top thing we did, it wouldn't have taken long before Lobo was revealed as a one-trick pony.
I understand.
And as much as I love assault humor, I don't want to wallow in it. You know?
I hear you.
Yeah, so and it's not like, you know, it's like at the 52 meeting, I officially passed Lobo on to one of the other writers.
I didn't know Lobo was in 52.
I'm not going to tell you who, but it will be an interesting take on the character.
Wow, okay, that's cool. I didn't know Lobo was going to be part of 52. Very interesting.
Look, a lot of people are going to be part of 52. We have the main characters. The entire DCU is part of 52. It's just that the main characters in 52, during that year that 52 is being published, will not be appearing in any other DC books. So if you like Renee Montoya, you got to come to 52 to get your Renee Montoya fix, because she ain't showing up in Batman until this is over.
No, I got you.
In the meantime, yeah, we've got the other DC characters showing up. Sure, we're in the middle of the DCU. It's really hard to have a major event go down and not have another hero show up. But yeah, it's so far it's a fun book. There are a couple of things in there that I think are going to stun the readers. Not so much that they're shocking, but that we will not be able to believe that we actually did this. We have one of those moments coming up where the boards are going to light up with, I don't believe they brought that one back.
Well, that's the thing that I'm looking forward to, and I hope when things are more underway and you know, we're maybe 6 months into the Blue Beetle and Annihilation and 52...
And Hero Squared, and Hero Squared, and Planetary Brigade. Don't forget, Boom is an important part of my life right now.
Absolutely.
You know, as much as I want the books I do with the mainstream comic companies to succeed, I also, you know, hope that more and more people who liked what I did on Defenders with Mark or what we did on the Justice League will start picking up Hero Squared or Planetary Brigade. If you like Lobo, you're going to love Jeremiah Harm. You know, it's me and Alan Grant together again. We're taking it to the next level. And you know, if the success of 52 and the success of Annihilation, if there is success to be had, of course, let's always keep that in mind.
Certainly.
If it could bleed over so that people might follow some of the people involved in these books into the smaller print things that they do, that just strengthens the comic book industry at home.
I agree, Keith. And I think the great thing is, you know, yeah, you came from so many of these guys now that are popular in the mainstream started with the small press, and it's nice to see guys like yourself and Mark Wade being able to do these new ideas with smaller companies, and I think that's great.
Yeah, and again, right now, I can say without fear of contradiction that when it comes to the small press, Boom is the best game in town, period. I'll just stand up and say, you know, there is no better small publisher out there to put your work through than Boom. Best deal, they know how to handle the talent, criminal honesty, the kind of honesty that sometimes you don't want to hear about. You know, the kind of thing where he'll go, you know, oh, well, yeah, you know your book? It sold like crap. I mean, and again, that was just off the top of my head. Nobody has told me or anyone else their book sold like crap. And again, it's important that these companies survive. So it's in my best interest. You know, I could put on the, you know, the halo and the martyr shirt and go, yes, I believe in giving back to the small press community. No. It's in my best interest to see companies like Boom thrive, because that's the place I can really hear my voice. Like, because as much as I will write for a major company, I've always got to pull back, because what I write and the contents of my work has to be filtered through that company's best interest. These characters have history. These characters have been around for a while. I can't just cut off Aquaman's hand because they have none. In the smaller press things, whether it's, you know, Kirkman working Invincible or Mark DeMatteis and I doing Hero Squared you know, John Rogers or any of the guys that contributed to those wonderful Zombie Tales anthologies,
mm-hmm.
you are hearing, that's where you can go to hear each creator's voice unfiltered. You know, because sometimes you don't want to go, boy, I wonder what, you know, so-and-so would do if he could just do whatever he wanted. Pick up a Boom book, because everyone in Boom is doing exactly what they want.
Very cool. And again, as you said, people were disappointed that the Justice League stuff was, you know, kind of terminated because of the direction of DC.
Yeah.
And for those who are missing that kind of story, it's right there for you in Hero Squared and Planetary Brigade, no question.
Yeah.
So I appreciate that, and honestly, I appreciate your time, man. You've given me a lot of time and a lot of stuff to work with. And
I'll sweat. I tend to ramble.
No, and again, as you'll hear from the finished product, tangents are welcome, and we're looking forward to the new stuff and continued success with the Boom Studio stuff and the major stuff as well.
Yeah, well, you know, it's once again, it's a good time to be in comics. You know, it got bad for a while there, but I think that once again, it's just a good time to be in comics, whether it's small press or the majors. And on that note, ta-da!
So there you go, a classic conversation with Keith Giffen from February of 2006 here on Word Balloon. Hope you enjoyed it. Thanks for listening. More Word Balloon coming up in March. Stay tuned in the days ahead. Great new stuff coming up. And we'll keep running the occasional Word Balloon flashback as we celebrate our 5th anniversary this year. That'll do it for this edition. Thanks again for listening. John Suntress reminding you, look for Word Balloon all over the internet. Of course, we're here at wordballoon.com. Make sure you subscribe to our RSS feed so you don't miss an episode. Lots of great stuff coming up. Also, check us out on iTunes. If you'd like to leave a review or rating, that would be great. I certainly appreciate those when they happen. And thanks to all the people that have done that in the past. Questions or comments about the show, you can either reach me via email, john@wordballoon.com, or come to the Word Balloon message board and post a question there. Follow me on Twitter, John Word Balloon. You can also ask me a question at my Facebook page under John Suntress, or you can ask me anything at formspring.me/wordballoon. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2010.